This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hello, Paul.
Well, hello, Susan. We're starting our day today with Amelia Schoeneman, and we can talk with her about what's happening in Story County.
Yes, she's with the Planning and Development Department. You're talking about stormwater management and draft resolutions?
Yes, so the Planning and Development Department is currently seeking public comment on proposed amendments to our stormwater and erosion control ordinance. This ordinance would apply to development in the unincorporated area of Story County. And we have a current ordinance, but that's limited to spacing requirements for sediment control barriers and requiring best management practices for stormwater control. And so the proposed ordinance would include a threshold based on an area disturbed or if environmentally sensitive areas were disturbed. If you were over the threshold, you would need to submit stormwater and erosion control plan and meet numeric criteria for stormwater runoff volume and rate. So we're seeking public input on this proposal. It's on our Story County Planning and Development website.
Oh, well, I resist asking, does this cover pipelines too as well?
Oh. the proposed threshold is based on, for erosion control, the area disturbed. So if you had a development that was disturbing over a certain square footage, it might be required to submit an erosion control plan. Or for stormwater, if you were creating a certain square footage of impervious area, you might be required to submit a stormwater control plan. But the state of Iowa also has a national pollutant elimination discharge permit for areas over 1 acre in size. So this would kind of be for developments that are under that threshold to ensure the county can control stormwater from those as well.
What organizations or people would be directly affected by this, or who would have to make presentations for you if they wanted to do a development?
That's a great question. So for the input, we're seeking input from all stakeholders in Story County. You know, that could be home builders, it could be, environmental groups, but it could just be the general public as well, folks that have a stake in the water quality here in Story County. We certainly want to hear from everyone.
So is there a meeting or a time coming up when you have this public meeting?
Yes.
You might really stress when that is.
Okay. So we are requesting that folks review the draft ordinance on our website. It's storycountyiowa.gov under the Planning and Development page and under Current Development Regulations, and provide us with comment by next Wednesday.
Wednesday, that would be the date of?
The 16th. The 18th, I'm sorry.
The 18th of April. So that's the deadline when they need to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we're planning on taking the proposal to our Planning and Zoning Commission for their May meeting, which is the first Wednesday in May at 4 p.m. in the Story County Administration Building at 906th Street in Nevada.
Well, how long have you been with Story County, Amelia?
I've been there about 2 years this summer.
So far, you love it, right?
Yeah.
Now, what are your responsibilities in your position?
So I'm a planner with the Planning and Development Department. We actually do quite a lot of different things in our department, beyond just drafting ordinances like this stormwater ordinance. We review permits for homes, for commercial buildings in unincorporated Story County. We review conditional use permits for things such as wind turbines and cell towers. We also staff several boards and commissions, the Planning and Zoning Commission, which makes recommendations on developments such as subdivisions and rezonings to the Board of Supervisors. And we also staff the Board of Adjustment, which hears cases that are more individual for individual development cases such as.
That's quite a wide-ranging job you have.
Yeah, it is.
And you're involved. You're on the ground floor and present at creation for a lot of things that will be in place for a long time in Story County.
Mm-hmm.
So that's got to be satisfying, because any job you have or any vocation that we have, it's nice to know it has impact beyond the days we spend at the office. Right?
Absolutely. And I also think, you know, that again is why it's so important that we get input on our proposals such as the stormwater ordinance, because they do have long term impacts and wide ranging impacts on the community. And I'm just happy to be able to reach out to folks and put things together for the long term here in our community.
We can't get too far into this, though, without knowing what's going on in Story County generally that Leanne normally will announce. And so I want you to, if you can, give us a rundown on what we need to know about what's happening in Story County.
Sure. So there's several Story County Board and Commission openings. Applications are currently being accepted for the Board of Adjustment and for the Veterans Affairs Commission. There's a deadline for those applications of 5 p.m. on Friday, June 29th. And you can find the application on our website, storycountyiowa.gov. You could also mail in or email your application to Deb Shildroth. And her email is dshildroth, S-C-H-I-L-D-R-O-T-H, at storycountyiowa.gov. We are getting a new website and going to go live with that website on Monday, April 16th. We hope it will be more intuitive and easy to use to find information that you're seeking. And then the Story County Blood Drive is coming up at the end of the month. Story County is hosting two blood drives. We have two dates and locations available. The first is Thursday, April 26th, and that's at the Human Services Center in Ames from 11 to 3. And the second is Friday, April 27th, at the Story County Administration Building in Nevada from noon to 5. If you have questions or would like to schedule an appointment, you can visit redcrossblood.org or call 515-382-7247. Also, May 6th through the 12th is Public Service Recognition Week. It's been celebrated since 1985, the first week in May, and Public Service Recognition Week is organized annually by the Public Employees Roundtable and its member organizations to honor the men and women who serve our nation as federal, state, county, and local government employees. So you can watch our social media pages to see some faces from the Story County government. And then we also have Citizen of the Year 2018. It's an award given annually to residents of Story County who perform meritorious service above and beyond what would be expected of a citizen. The Board of Supervisors announced that the 2018 Citizen of the Year was Mr. Kevin Cooper on April 3rd. Congratulations to him. He is an agricultural education instructor with the Nevada School District, and he was nominated by his FFA students.
So a Citizen of the Year, and he's the Citizen of the Year this year, or is that last?
Yep, 2018.
2018 Citizen of the Year, and he's from Nevada. He's the FFA instructor. And so now looking ahead to next year, I'd like to nominate Susan Franson for that, Citizen of the Year. Susan, we're on record here as nominating you.
No. I'd like to have you interview the Citizen of the Year. That's the thing that I look forward to. But it actually sounds like he's a very interesting choice. Maybe we could talk to him on KHOI. I would like to do that.
Well, every week in the Sun, you know, there's all these things highlighted about what's going on. And the Nevada FFA chapter dominates that. There are pictures, activities. This man really has made the FFA segment of education in Nevada premier in Iowa, one of the best in Iowa. So he deserves that, just from my observation of how much publicity there is about the FFA chapter in Nevada. So I think he's very deserving. Now back to your quadrant of responsibility.
Sure.
Susan, I think, did you have a question for her?
Well, I was thinking about having lived in an unincorporated area myself for a year, and my daughter lives just on the outskirts of Ames, and I know you do. What are the controversial things that you have to deal with there?
Well, I think with any community, you know, there's always certain developments that folks have concerns or comments about, you know, whether that's from a new subdivision to simply, you know, a variance for somebody to build a garage closer to their front property line. It's just, it really depends.
Oh, so that's part of what you cover.
Sure.
It's not just water, groundwater.
No. It also is development activities in the county as well.
You know, and I've noticed as I've driven around that there are, in surprising places, like what looks like the middle of a cornfield out near Gilbert, there's a big subdivision.
Sure.
Plopped right down there. And I guess that means, of course, every one of those lots has to be at least 1 acre, correct?
It depends on the zoning district. So in the unincorporated area, we have several different zoning districts. So about 80% of the unincorporated area is zoned A1 agricultural. And in that zoning district, you are required to have 35 net acres to construct a single family dwelling. You would, in your more dense residential zoning districts, have a minimum lot size of 1 acre. We have an even more dense residential district called the R1 residential district, and that's a minimum lot size of 25,000 square feet. And so, you know, in order, like I said before, most areas are zoned A1 agricultural. And so in order to do a development, there would be a rezoning process. Part of that rezoning process, and actually in our Story County land development regulations, we look at the agricultural value, the crop suitability rating for a property to ensure it's not over a certain threshold. And if it's under, if it has low agricultural value, then it can be rezoned to a more intense residential district. And then they'd also have to go through a subdivision and platting process as well.
Well, about this difference between 1 acre and 2,500 square feet, when Luther, which of course is not in Story County, mm-hmm. when it disincorporated, I guess, mm-hmm. I understood that was exactly because of the expense of updating their wastewater treatment plant. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these people on the edges of town had put in quite expensive septic mm-hmm. systems, and they didn't want to. So it was over the issue of not groundwater, but sewage.
Sure. That's interesting. I'm not familiar with that one. Again,
mm-hmm. it's another county.
Yeah. Yeah. We have the Story County Environmental Health Department that handles septic systems, as well as wells and other environmental health issues such as nuisances. And we share an office with them. So we do work pretty closely with environmental health that looks at wastewater issues.
Thank you for being here today. This has been fascinating, and your wealth of knowledge is impressive. That's good, because she's with Planning and Development for Story County. Amelia Shoneman, who is here today from Story County, and she also updated us on all the happenings in Story County and all the things you need to know about what's coming up in Story County. Thanks, Amelia.
Thank you.
In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio, and we just heard from Amelia Shoneman with the Story County Report. As she leaves, we'll turn to an immigrant community that has been growing in Ames for many years. That also gives us a chance to learn about another African country, South Sudan, which separated from Sudan officially in 2011. They have some pretty dramatic stories, our guests, and my first interview is with Paul Luth.
My name is Paul Luth, from Ames. I was born in South Sudan, been here the majority of my life, came here on my fourth birthday. My dad and four other siblings of my mom came here for my dad to pursue his degree, master's in agriculture economics. He followed John Gurung here. After John Gurung had graduated, they were friends, and the suggestion was to come here. So that's why he came here.
And who's John Gurung?
John Gurung, he was the president of South Sudan for maybe 6 months, but he was part of the whole Sudan, and then rights weren't being given to southern Sudanese because they were either not Muslim or Arab. And so there was a little rebellion that occurred early 80s because the rights for people from the South were basically being discriminated against. Well, so he came in 82. The rebellion started in 83. He's still being supported by all of Sudan because it's still a country then. And then he kind of sided with the faction because he was a southerner and he was not being treated equally to his counterparts. So he stayed, finished his master's here, then pursued his PhD at Oklahoma State University.
Where did you live when you were in Ames?
I lived in a beautiful place called University Village in Pamela Court. So those are the two places I lived. It was just full of graduate students, who were kind of older with a lot of families. And so it was really cool. You'd be able to just walk and see different nationalities from one door to the other, different languages, smell different foods. It was just really beautiful. Kids would leave their bikes there and you'd be able to borrow it and you wouldn't have to worry about someone taking it. It was kind of like a communal type of setting. And it was so different from the outside world because once you left Shaletta Village or University Village or Pamela Court or Hawthorne Court, the demographic would change drastically. And so most of my friends were either from South America or the Middle East or Africa or Europe.
Recently on this program, we also had a description of Pamela Court from Jane Adjiman.
Yeah.
Did you know her?
Of course. I call her Auntie Jane. Her son is one of my closest friends. We went to high school together and middle school and one year in elementary school. So, yeah, so there's a community that kind of the friendship stays strong because we kind of shared life together when we first came in. And we had similar stories. We were immigrants coming to learn and to better our lives, but we didn't have the resources that everybody within outside of our little enclave. And so it was a really special time and moment and filled with laughter and just great stories. So we got from 82 to 85. My dad finished his degree, then went to Stillwater, Oklahoma, OSU, to get his PhD, pursue his PhD in agriculture economics also. And then we came back, and my dad got a job here at the financial aid department.
And then you moved into a house in town?
Yes, we moved into a house. Moved in South Ames, Southdale, kind of by Kate Mitchell. And so, yeah, so it was a different community, but it was still a great community to live in. And big family. By that time, there were 8 kids.
In your family?
Yes, and 2 adults. So it was very large. When we came from the U.S., there were 5. And then so...
What did you do after you graduated?
And started school here at Iowa State. So pursued a degree in genetics, a minor in microbiology, and met my wife there and kind of really started to really appreciate Ames and Iowa State. So,
what did you do after you got your master's?
Well, that was just recently, but I'm working here at Iowa State. So, but I left after my bachelor's. I worked in Boston for a couple years. That was quite an experience, and then came back just because of separation of my wife is still here pursuing her PhD. And so it was pretty hard. I thought I was man enough to take it, but I realized that it was pretty tough. So after about a year and a half, I returned from Boston to come here, and it was a great decision to come back.
Well, have you ever been back to Sudan?
Yeah, I came here in 82. There was a lot of flux in our situation. And so we actually were on political asylum because of the dangers of going back, and also who my dad was. He was a brigadier general, kind of one of the top officials in the rebellion. And so he couldn't even go back to any of the, at the time, 8 neighboring countries because they were afraid he was going to start something. So it was pretty difficult for him. We've had a couple of his brothers pass away while we're here. And he was unable to go because there were certain restrictions on where he could go and where he couldn't go. So 29 years later, 28, I went to South Sudan. He did in 2005. The Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed in 2005, and he went back. And so he went back, and he was assigned the position of ambassador of Sudan to the U.S., and so... He did that for a couple of years, and then he's ambassador of Sudan to Switzerland. And after that, that's when I decided to go back and see my grandma. I hadn't seen her for 29 years. And so that was 2011, I think, 2010, 2011. And then I went back again recently, a couple of years ago, 2016.
And so when you go back, what does it look like?
It looks very interesting. I mean, there you see development, but you still see the devastation of what the war has done with lives. Last time I went in 2016, I was, I should preface it with the understanding that my family is pretty well off considering, most of the people in South Sudan. So I was in a, little cafe in kind of downtown Juba, and I was sitting down with my cousin and we were talking, and, I saw this kid and he was clearly homeless, and we were eating a full plate of food, and he was definitely hungry, looked disheveled, clothes dirty, certainly an orphan. And I just gave him my whole plate. And so you see kind of a stark difference in lifestyles. You'll see individuals who are very well off driving very expensive cars, and right next door you'll see, you know, homeless people. And so it's pretty hard to see and witness those things, so...
So really, right next door, so you don't have enclaves of very wealthy people and then...
You do, but, you know, if you go to the market, right, or if you're... Somebody will be walking, another person will have the resources to be driving a car, you know, maybe a Land Cruiser. And so you see the difference. It's not as streamlined as it is here in the U.S. So you just have everybody jumbled up together sometimes, so...
We have seen, I think, news and so forth, are the refugee camps.
Mm-hmm.
Are those near Juba?
That's, most of the people are escaping South Sudan to go to a place of refuge. So maybe on the borders, but most of the people, I think there's right now around 2 million refugees that have left Sudan because it's basically a hostile territory. It's a war. There's a civil war going on. And so... a lot of people have escaped to other countries, even back to Sudan, ironically. So I didn't see any refugee camps when I was there, but I was in the bigger city. And I also went to kind of my ancestral home, and it's pretty peaceful there, too. But you have your, I would say, refugee camps, but I didn't see any.
Your father had originally come to study agricultural economics. So what would he have done with agricultural economics if he'd gone back?
Oh, well, I think, Sudan, South Sudan probably has... soil is comparable to Iowa soil. You can basically grow anything on it. And so it's a very fertile country. And also it's a very pastoral type of agricultural environment. And so that's how people lived. And so John Garang was also agriculture economics, and they wanted to kind of improve the livelihood of the country by growing food. And so that was kind of, I think, his objective, to improve the lives by providing resources for the people and the world. So,
what kind of farming do they have? Do they have large farms or small farms?
I would say it's smaller, but...
what does smaller mean?
A couple acres, but it depends. Like my grandfather, he was a sultan, a Muslim sultan, so he had 28 wives, and his land was very large. So he had to be able to accommodate all his wives and all his children. So his land mass was... That's my grandfather from my mom's side. My grandfather from my dad's side, he was a Christian missionary, a Catholic missionary, and so he didn't really have a lot, and he was only married to one woman. And so the farm he had was pretty substantial, but nothing like thousands of acres. So,
well, how was it farmed? Was it farmed with tractors?
No. Just old school, you know, I guess would be antiquated farming methods.
With hand tools?
Yep. My dad's dad was a Catholic missionary, and my mom's dad was a Muslim sultan, and they kind of got together, which is interesting. My dad started fighting at 12. He had to protect. At that time, there would be raids, like we mentioned, and they would come in the village and just attack people. And so at 12 years old, he had to quit school and start war. So at 12, he was fighting in the army until about 20, and he would go all around South Sudan and protect just the region. But he also went to Kenya, Uganda. That's how he kind of learned those different languages, is because he was being helped. And he actually went to Israel for about 4 or 5 years to be trained. And so I remember him telling me, the last time I visited him in South Sudan, he said, you know, when I first left, I gave your mother... My mom was 15 when they got married. He was maybe 21. And so you just tell me the image of he's going off to war, and he gives my mom, who was pregnant at the time, an AK-47, just like a rifle, and said, here, you're going to have to take care of the house. And so so she was taking care of his siblings, too. And so, yeah, that's kind of a lot of deaths because of the war. And so that's one thing that makes us strikingly different from the normal American family. You know, you get phone calls in the morning hearing that so-and-so died of something that would be trivial here, but it's so common there. So those are kind of the hard days. Or when you get here, someone's sick, you never know if they'll survive or not. And one of my hardest times in my life is my brother passed away, and he died of cholera and typhoid.
Where was he?
He was in Sudan. And so, you know, you just have to, you know, those are the hard things. You know, you try to do something, you try to see if you could change, and but those are the difficulties that you face. And then there are other difficulties, just culturally trying to blend in and be like everybody when you're obviously not in appearance, but also socioeconomically. But you learn how to just deal with it. I think children are very resilient at that.
Now, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was the food, because as you know, there is a new Sudanese restaurant.
I just ate there on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. What did you think? Did you think it was authentic? Did you like it?
I liked it. The food was good. You have to also understand that my cousin is one of the owners. And my brother and my niece and my cousin, other cousin, all work there. So I might be a little biased. But I think it's one thing that I was noticed is as the restaurant opened, we all came together, helped. And so it was really nice to see that. And so I'm wishing the best for her. She came here and she's just trying to make a better life for herself. And so it was really beautiful to see that. I was telling my boss that, you know, there's my big fat Greek wedding. It kind of reminded me of that, but I would call it my tall, skinny Sudanese restaurant. So, yeah, but it's really nice, and it's a sign of representation within the community when you could have a restaurant that represents a group of people and the food and the region. There's a really richness to it. So I hope it does well. And there's been a lot of community support for it. So
we've just been hearing from Paul Luth telling about growing up in Ames and the relations he still has with family in South Sudan. And as he left the studio, he mentioned that he was on his way over to the new Sudanese restaurant to wash dishes. I wanted to see what this community venture was like. So a few days later, I went over for lunch, which was prepared by Awin Majok. While Awin was in the kitchen, I spoke with one of the other three owners. Dot Bol, why did your family come when they did?
Actually, my brother was here first. My brother came to the United States and played a professional basketball in the NBA. We lost our parents when I was young, so he decided to bring us here, my sister and I. And I don't know if you know the first tall NBA player, Manute Bol, from Africa. Yeah, that's how we got to the United States.
And that was your brother?
Yes, that was my brother, my older brother. I came to Iowa because my best friend, who I call my sister, Awien, was here. And I was in Kansas, Olathe, Kansas. That's where I live. But then later on, I decided to come to Iowa because she was here. And after I came to Iowa, we talked and we talked and we said, okay, now what do we do? I mean, we've been best friends since we were little. If you want to better yourself, you can better yourself. Yeah, so we said, okay, we're going to open a store. There's three of us, Awien, Achok, and I. So we opened a store in Des Moines. Well, driving to Des Moines was a little bit tough with the children. We have young children, and we said, okay, why don't we think of a restaurant? And Awien is the one that came up with the idea of a restaurant, and I was afraid. I was scared. I said, how can we manage it? And she said, yes, we will do it. And I have a faith on her sometimes. If she said, okay, we're going to do this, we'll do it. Even to move a mountain, we will do it. I first disagree, but then I support the idea, and then we go up. We are good cooks. I cook good. She cook good. Also, a Chuck cooks good. And I know that people will like our food, our South Sudanese or Sudanese food, because we make both.
Tell me about the differences in the South Sudanese and the Sudanese food.
We don't have any difference in the Sudanese food and South Sudanese food. We cook exact the same soup that South Sudanese cook, except one dish that South Sudanese don't cook. We call it asida. Asida is, I don't know if you know farina, it's kind of like a cornmeal. We cook it with buttermilk. And then we put butter in it, and it's kind of like dessert. That is the only food that is different from Sudanese. Almost the food that we cook in Sudan, general, is almost Middle Eastern food. And South Sudanese, since we were born there and raised there, we cook the same way. So we do have hummus. We have other stuff, other beans. We call it ful madamas. We also have that one. And Middle Eastern have that too. We also have a Jewish milo. We call it malokia. That is theirs too, but we South Sudanese, we cook it too because we grow it back too in South Sudan.
I heard that South Sudan has very rich farmland and it's very productive. In your family, did you live in the city or did you have any contact with agriculture?
I grew up in the city since I was a baby. But I still go back to the village. We call them villages. And yes, South Sudan is a very, 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 very rich. And in fact, last time I went, that was July of 2007. It's like an open space, and you can almost grow everything anywhere, like food. So I was sleeping and got up in the morning, and I asked my sister-in-law, I said, why don't you guys clean this one up? Why are you guys letting the grass come in the house? And she said, this is not grass, this is food. I will cook it for you tomorrow and you're going to eat it. And I said, okay. So I got up in the morning and it looks like spinach. It's just like spinach, but it's a little bit sour. She made it with peanut butter and I went out and then I came back. I was like, this is good. What is this? And she was like, this is the grass that you were talking about. And I said, okay, you can grow food anywhere? She said, yes. And it was very amazing, amazing. And also fruits. We have fruits everywhere, mangoes. Sometimes people will go and get mangoes and go and sell them. Even though my own house, we have like 3 mango trees. So South Sudan, yes, we have a lot.
I understand you also have a terrible famine right now with millions of people who are refugees from starvation who are going to other countries like Uganda. And so what is the distribution problem?
Problem right now is between the government. They started, and then the citizens are the ones that suffer from it. We have a lot of citizens that left South Sudan to go to neighboring country like Uganda, Kenya, and some of them even go to Chad, and the other ones even go to Khartoum. They will walk, go back to North Sudan. It's just the agreement between a vice president, and it's just a political thing. And then later on, they turned it into tribal issue. And then I don't know if that was the way of one of them trying to win the war or what is it. I'm not a political person. I don't know a lot about political, but I know a little bit. There was a UN there, and there are people there. And one time I went and I asked, I said, oh, yeah, it's refugee camp. How can you become a refugee in your own country? It's sad, very sad. And sometimes I do blame us citizens sometimes because I feel like we make the situation worse. For example, I'm Dinka, and then there is Nuer. And the biggest people right now in South Sudan is Dinka, Nuer, and Equatorians. Those three are the major problems. And people are afraid. Even me, when I go to South Sudan, if they ask you, like, what tribe are you? Because you don't know who you're talking to. You might be talking to Nuer, and I would die because I'm Dinka. Or I might be talking to Dinka, and I might die because I'm rare. You know, in that situation, you don't know what to say. Like, okay, what tribe am I? I don't know. And it's because of political.
I guess that was my other question here. Is there a difference here in America? You're the South Sudanese, mm-hmm. but do you distinguish somebody else or know they're Dinka here?
You can, because with older generation, you can tell. But in our generation, you cannot tell. Because the older generations, they have marks. Some of them have marks in the head, and they can tell. Because different tribe, like Chuluk, will have their own little mark in their face. Equatorians don't have marks, but physically, when you see them, you can know that those are not Dinka, Nuer, or other people. But in our generation now, if I find a Nuer girl, she just looked like me. There's no way I can tell. Or if a Chuluk lady or me, Dinka, we're all the same and there's no way we can tell. Unless if someone pointed out like, okay, I am actually from this tribe. And whatever is going on back home is affecting us in this country too.
We've just heard from Dot Bol, who has one of the owners of the safari. And as she finished, we were joined by Ashok Daud, the tall, willowy woman who had served us lunch. She spoke gratefully about the help of Paul Luth and his family when they were getting the restaurant ready. And that was for the what he called the tall, skinny Sudanese restaurant. Let's hear from Ashok now. How did you get involved with these women who wanted to start a restaurant?
Like I said, I've known them, their family, for so long. And we've always talked about having a restaurant, but it was just, you know, everything else that was in the way at the moment. And so I think our first time actually starting a business together was when we had our grocery store in Des Moines, which then transformed to the restaurant when we found this location. And so when they brought it up to my attention, I was like, yeah, absolutely. I think it'll be a wonderful experience for the world to kind of try Southern Sudanese food, you know, kind of see, kind of have like a first hand of how what we eat within our culture, as well as how we present ourselves as well, too. And there's not that many Sudanese restaurants in the world that I know of, especially in Ames, Iowa. And so when we decided to do this, I was really excited for it.
You must have a huge amount of support to get this started. Do you have investors who bought your furniture and things like
no,
that?
No, we did it ourselves.
Really?
Yep, we did it. There was no
financial support.
Yeah. Oh, we got one support from my friend, one of our friends that we go to church with.
Mm-hmm.
Financially, she really did support mm-hmm. us. And the rest of the communities, yes, they come and clean, and but they all
yeah,
help.
Definitely.
Yeah, the whole family came and helped us, including his mom, too. Everyone came and helped. Everyone in the community came.
Yeah.
And also our employees, too. They're very young, but they helped so much. And then after we were done, we hired them.
Yeah, because they started just coming in and help us get ready for the grand opening and the restaurant period. But we've seen how dedicated they were to us.
While we were talking with Ashok and Dot, there was music in the background, so I asked Ashok if she had a CD. She referred me to YouTube. Among the many South Sudanese performers there was a name I recognized, Dot Bol, performing in Omaha, Nebraska. I suppose that's not surprising for someone who grew up in Olathe, Kansas. I'm from Kansas, too, so when I heard her say Kansas, I thought, yeah, that's she talks like a Kansan. Here's Dot Bol singing at a party.
You
KHOI Community Radio. I'm Paul Wearson, your host for today, together with my co-host Susan Franson, who's been visiting with some South Sudanese immigrants, telling us about the Safari, a new South Sudanese restaurant at 217 Duff here in Ames.
Our last guests, Kathy Nelk and Mr. Z, are here with a preview of some of the things coming up at the Erickson Public Library in Boone. I'm impressed with how important public libraries are to towns of any size in our listening area. Boone, the county seat of Boone County, is one of the largest towns in our listening area with a stable population of 12,000. It also has one of the oldest libraries. I'm eager to hear how they have combined the traditional functioning of a library with the new activities that 21st century libraries are creating.
Well, we have Candy Nelk and Mr. Z here today from the Boone Library.
Good morning.
And first, we need to put this in context. What's the history of the Erickson Public Library? This building is an older building, isn't it? Who wants to feel that one?
Sure, I can do that. So it's been around since 1885, and so our slogan is Enriching Lives Since 1885. So it is on the National Historic Registry. And so it's been serving the Boone community. It's evolved through that time. It really started off as more of like an academic type library, and then as it has continued into the 21st century, it's more now a community hub that provides, of course, literature and lots of programs.
Well, so, why is it called the Erickson Library? What's the background
there? Yeah, Senator Erickson was the individual who gave money during that period to create a library.
Now, there are some mixed blessings here. You have a building that's pretty old. There are a lot of maintenance issues, I'm sure, and a need for constant reinvestment to bring it up to date, sustain it. Is that kind of a challenge sometimes?
Yes, it is. It's a continual problem that we have that just need to keep funding our library, and it does have huge maintenance issues. It's one of the biggest city buildings in Boone. So.
But, you know, it's so great to have that because that building itself is precious. As you said, that really is on the National Historic Registry, and it's got to be one of the premier buildings in Boone in terms of historical reference and, well, just look at all the generations of children who grew up to be adults who look back on that as their literary source as they were growing up. And so it's an old building, but it's a vital modern program you have. And Candy, you may tell us about some of the things going on that you're responsible for in the program at the library.
Yes. I work with teens and young adults and also adult programming. We have a program coming up this weekend about Jane Austen. It's called Keep Calm and Keep and Read Jane Austen. It's presented by historian Kathy Wilson, and it's going to present to our patrons a program why Jane Austen, after 200 years, why she is still such an important aspect of our lives, why she's a classic, what influenced her writing, and so we're very eager to – we've heard very good things about this presenter and eager to give this program to our patrons.
Well, I think a library for young people is a link to all the heritage they have as a person growing up in America and as a person growing up in the world. It's our responsibility to let them know who Jane Austen is and who all the literary figures of the past are. That's your exposure that they have to our culture, our background, our history. And like all great literature, as you pointed out, it has application with what's going on in the world today, what a teenager's life, what a young girl growing up is experiencing.
Yes.
So this is the great value of a library, to keep that cultural reference and let young people know that no matter how long ago something might have been written, it had application to their daily life. And so that's what you're doing with this program.
Yes. It's mostly to appeal to adults, but also young adults are invited to attend. Should be about an hour long. And we're very eager to have this woman come and speak.
That's
going to
be great.
Patrons.
And we have Mr. Z, too, now. Mr. Z, how did you come by that name? You must have a Z in your name.
I do. So my name is Zach, and that name, Mr. Z, has been around in my life well over 10 years. And so I used to work at the Bondurant Community Library, and I was visiting a school, a preschool. And a little kiddo gave me the title Mr. Z.
And so it's Mr. Z forever.
I am Mr. Z forever. I actually, when folks see me in the community, they actually apologize sometimes because they call me that. And I said, no, I will respond to that.
Well, it puts you in the same category with Cher. You know, all you've got is one name that you're universally recognized. So
sure.
A lot of people have a whole career in show business and never have one name recognition.
Sure.
You're there already.
Yeah.
Now, you might tell us about some of the programs. You do a lot of things for children at the library, and we need to know about that so that we know what's going on at Boone. So give us a little hint of what's going on for young people.
Yeah, so my responsibility, I'm the children's librarian. I run the children's department, which if you come to our library, it is three stories, so the basement, the first, and the second. So downstairs, one-third of the entire library is dedicated to kids, which is awesome. And so I start programs from infant all the way up to about fifth grade, and then I work with the teen librarians to create programs that are multi-age from fifth grade on up. And so we every week have story time Wednesday and Thursdays, and that's open to all children up to about 5 years old. It's pretty exciting because it's very interactive. We have, of course, books and songs and movement, but we really want the parents to engage with their kiddos. So even though we plan these programs, they really don't follow the curriculum per se, because we just want to make learning fun. And we do have an infant story time up to about age two, which really focuses on those developmental stages. And then first three Tuesdays of the month at 6:30, we have Family Fun, which is our evening story times. And then we have one story time a month on Saturday. So our goal with our layout for those story time programs is to ensure that families can come during the day. Some need to come at night, and then, of course, on the weekend. So we want to accommodate that need as much as possible. And then we do offer some after-school programming for the elementary students. And I think if I have time, you know, during this session to talk about our NASA Academy, our NASA at My Library program. That's been a very popular program that's been a year long, and it will be in a second year is coming. And then we just sprinkle in some special programs. And in fact, next Thursday is one of the largest programs that we're going to be doing to conclude our first year for NASA at My Library.
Well, how long have you been at the Boone Library?
I've been at the Boone Library. It'll be 7 years in October.
Well, congratulations.
Thank
Your anniversary's
you.
Coming up.
Anniversary's coming up.
Well, by now, everyone knows who Mr. Z is. And so you've just covered a lot of different programs mm-hmm. for different age groups.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do anything when there's an early dismissal from school? In our library in Story City, there's always something going on the days where there's an early dismissal mm-hmm. when the kids have the afternoon free.
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, we were one out of 75 of the nation to get a NASA at My Library grant. And so that's one of our most popular programs. It's called NASA Academy. So it appeals to elementary students, and we focus entirely on outer space, and we bring in speakers, and we do things with the green screen, and we do things with infrared cameras. So it really opens to opportunities for STEM-related learning. And then we offer creative programs. One is called Library Lab. So it's a creative program in that we just set a bunch of supplies up and kiddos can create whatever design, whatever creation they want. But STEM is really, or I should say STEAM. STEAM is really what's becoming the great focus for these after-school programs, and that's what we're going to be developing in the future.
Well, you've got so many creative things going on mm-hmm. for youth and kids mm-hmm. of all ages, spanning right. the real from preschool on. And then I want to know from Candy what your responsibilities are. Mr. Z has the kids covered. So what are you doing over there at Boone's Library?
Yes, I recently started at the library. I used to work at the library, and now I'm back. And I'm kind of a jack of all trades. I do the calendar, the monthly calendar. I put out press releases to the news media, to the radio, so that the community can find out what we're all about and what we're presenting. I work the desk. I do a story time on Saturday so that the families that can't come in the mornings or they can't come through the week, they have an opportunity to bring their children on Saturday. It's been very popular. So I'm just kind of wherever they need me, that's where I am. But I also work a lot with adult programming. We have recently started a four-month-long program about from the Alzheimer's Association. It's a lunch and learn where they come the second Monday of the month, and an Alzheimer's Association volunteer is teaching us about the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia. It's a very informative program. I've already learned a lot.
Sounds great. You know, the thing that comes to mind, and of course, full disclosure, I'm on the Library Foundation Board for Bertha Bartlett Library in Story City. So yes. I'm very attuned to what happens in a library and the kind of programming demands and the variety from all the age groups served to all the programs you need to do. And what's your feeling, either of you, about what's the library's role is changing? You know, we're into a digital age. Mm-hmm. We're into an age where kids have a different reference point when they do research. You know, do they still need to learn the Dewey Decimal System, or do we just Google it, you know? So that's a changing world, isn't it, Mr. Z?
It is a very changing world. You know, research is still showing that even children prefer print materials. But digital continuously is something I focus on. How do we integrate that? But wanting to draw attention to the fact that children are in different developmental stages. So children in the story time age group, I'm very careful not to immerse too much digital resources in that program because I want them to focus on the joy of the print material. But yeah, as they continue to grow up and, you know, become active in school and do school projects. It's our responsibility to ensure that we're keeping up with those resources, that we're integrating more applications and really updating our computers and working with the schools to understand where their needs are at from a digital perspective.
Well, you know, I like to hear that because libraries, you know, we talk about books and the Dewey Decimal System mm-hmm. and all the stuff we're familiar with who have been on the planet for a long time. Candy, do you have anything to add before we close?
Well, we try to right now everybody is so busy and trying to pull people in, just offer them programming and information about things that they're interested in. We've done Instant Pots. People didn't even know about Instant Pots, but we've done programs about Instant Pots. We're doing programs about composting. We're doing upcoming programs about the royal wedding. So just trying to touch base with what's out there in the news media, what people are relating to, and what we can bring in for their information.
Well, I hate to say that I'm not invited to the wedding, but we've been talking with Candy Nelk and Mr. Z about all the activities and goings-on at the library in Boone. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Paul Wearson and I, Susan Franzen, have been your hosts for today. Other voices you heard were Amelia Schoenemann, Paul Luce, Dot Bol, Ashok Dowd, Zach Steer, a.k.a. Mr. Z, and Candy Nelk.
And you can listen to today's Local Talk Show and any of our past Local Talk Shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. Now there you will find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed.
Local Talk was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley, a South Sudanese song from YouTube simply titled Dot Bol performing in Omaha, Nebraska.
Well, Local Talk is a local radio production training workshop as well as a show. And if you would like to join the team here at KHOI as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you will decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for the yellow donate button.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again on the radio.
For KHOI comes from ISU Theater, presenting Our Town, a story of a small New England town at the turn of the last century, April 20th through the 29th in Ames. Tickets and showtimes available at theater.iastate.edu.